Well, that is about all I have to say by way of introduction this evening. Now let's get to the meat of the broadcast and begin what's going to be probably at least 3, maybe 4 weeks of archival material on a very, very touchy subject. Again, the use of satanic cults as fronts by the U.S. National Security Establishment. I guess you could say that this broadcast is going to be, could be titled Ultimate Evil 2, Satanism, Mind Control, and the U.S. National Security Establishment. I'm going to give you a rundown of this evening's broadcast. We're going to begin by taking a look at a reputed gay satanic cult murder performed by a fellow by the name of St. Joseph. After that, we're going to take a look at reports of another possibly satanic-linked gay crime, namely a molestation case in which a fellow who's associated with something called the North American Man-Boy Love Association and also possibly appears to have connecting links, perhaps defunct links, to elements of the OTO. It's an occult group which is a subject of some controversy. There have been charges that elements of OTO or offshoot groups or someone using their name have in fact been involved in the types of activities that Maury Terry talks about in his book. It is not at all clear whether just what those elements are, whether it's rogue elements of OTO, someone masking and using their name, whether it's elements of the OTO that have been infiltrated by intelligence services and are being used as a front, or just what the case is. The OTO themselves officially decry this type of activity and disown it. Whether or not that organization has, whether rogue factions of it, splinter factions of it, people using their name, defunct members, or whether intelligence services infiltrating this organization have been able to utilize elements of it in a, the specific capacity that we're talking about here, remains to be determined. I want to avoid people chiming in future weeks talking about defending the OTO. I'm trying to clarify here that the waters are very, very muddy. I'm not necessarily exonerating anybody or anything, but the OTO, which is an occult group which follows the teachings of Aleister Crowley, officially decries the kinds of activities that we've described in our program on the ultimate evil and that we're going to be going into tonight. Sexual molestation, murder, drug dealing, and things of this kind. Again, they officially decry those kinds of activities, and for all I know, the denial and denunciation of those kinds of activities is absolutely on the level. However, there are a number of firm indications that elements, perhaps, of the OTO, perhaps rogue elements, perhaps people that were members at one time and were expelled, perhaps intelligence services that have infiltrated elements of the OTO and are using it for their own ends are in fact engaged in this activity. And I think there is a lot of investigation in the direction of the OTO that needs to be done. You note my use of the term here, in the direction. I'm not pointing the finger at any individual or at an organization necessarily, nor am I absolving any individual or organization necessarily. One of the problems with dealing with the intelligence services is that intelligence work is not done on the surface. It's all done sub rosa. It's done clandestinely. Intelligence agents don't walk around on a covert operation with Delaney tags saying, "Hi, my name is such and such. I'm an undercover agent for, say, the DIA. It doesn't work that way, people. So when I talk about OTO, it may be that it's simply elements of it that are being used, perhaps against the wishes or with even perhaps without the knowledge of the leaders of that organization. The P2 Lodge, the Propaganda Douay Lodge that we talk about so often, is an example to be borne in mind. That organization itself served as literally a crypto-fascist government, which for all practical purposes ran and to a considerable extent apparently still runs Italy behind the scenes. Yet many members of the P2 Lodge, which itself was a front and founded for that purpose, were completely ignorant of the activities, and they had joined it and acted in concert with the other members in good faith. When you're dealing with the intelligence services, you're dealing with something that can operate without the knowledge, perhaps, of even those quite close to it. So, as I say, I think there's a lot of work, a lot of investigation to be done in the direction of the OTO in conjunction with the activities we're speaking about this evening. But, again, I want to make it clear that the waters are rather muddy here, and it's unclear whether it's elements of it, rogue elements of it, infiltrated elements of it, former elements of it, or whether perhaps they're simply lying in their teeth. I would urge our listeners here to consider any and all of those possibilities in the context of our discussion. There is much food for thought and much grounds for further research, as we like to say, in this context. After that, we're going to take a look at yet another article about this fellow White, who was not only a homosexual and alleged child molester. I guess he was convicted of child molestation, but he also apparently had AIDS and may have spread it to many of his victims, quite a few of them, in fact, including a lot of children. We're then going to take a look at something that we dealt with in our archive show on the Pink Triangle. That was our examination of the Third Reich, gay rights, and reproductive rights. We're going to take a look specifically at an apparent provocation which was used to tar liberal politics in Germany and to terrify the population in a specific homophobic way. We're going to take a look at the Fritz Haarmann case. And if people are not aware of what the Fritz Haarmann case is, stick around. We're going to go into that in considerable detail tonight via a section from one of our archive shows called The Pink Triangle. Again, gay rights, reproductive rights, and the Third Reich. After that, we're going to take a look at an interesting situation whereby reports of a satanic cult human sacrifice apparently panicked the population of Macomb, Mississippi to a considerable extent. We're going to reflect on that against the background of the Fritz Haarmann case. Then we're going to come back to the St. Joseph case, a particularly brutal killing in which has been alleged to be not only satanic, and apparently was a satanic killing, but specifically a gay satanic killing as well, or so we were told. We're then going to reflect on the brutal elements of certain satanic practices, the murder, the mutilation, the cannibalism, the drinking of blood, and so forth, the blood rituals, against the background of mind control. And we're going to dip again into our archives, and we're going to play a section from Radio Free America show number 5. That is the first part of a three-part series called Operation Mind Control. And specifically, we're going to deal with the conditioning of mind control assassins by the military. And again, that will be via tape this evening. Then we're going to read a section from a book called The Black March. That's the autobiography of a Waffen SS man and the account primarily of his experiences on the Eastern Front during World War II. We're going to reflect on the SS training program against the background of our thesis, our underlying thesis this evening, namely the use of certain satanic cults as mind control fronts by the U.S. National Security Establishment, basically as espionage organizations and as tools for the implementation of certain kinds of fascist policies. And again, we're not talking about the devil. One of the reasons why these satanic cults make such excellent fronts is that specifically, well, the intelligence services over the years have long, of all countries, have long sought occult groups as fronts, but they're using satanic cults because the whole idea of Satanism almost automatically lends itself to either ridicule and or sensationalism, and therefore it makes an excellent cover for espionage. After taking a look at the Black March and specifically reflecting on the satanic cult against the background of the SS training centers, we're going to go back into another of our archive tapes, namely the program called The Ultimate Evil Part 1, again subtitled Satanism, Mind Control, and the U.S. National Security Establishment. Specifically, we're going to review some of the material on the Temple of Set and some of our ruminations about the possibility, and again I say the possibility, of connections between the Temple of Set and some of the activities described in Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil. And again, I stress, note the use of the word possibility there. It's not a hard connection by any stretch of the imagination, but there are some evidentiary tributaries connecting the two. We will reflect on those. We'll take a look at the Temple of Set. We'll take a look at Michael Aquino's affinity for SS occult ritual and other activities in a long tape segment, approximately 40-45 minutes in length. Then we're going to take a look at the Presidio child molestation case and reflect on that against the background of some things. We're going to take a look at a brutal murder of a woman at the Presidio, and we will muse on whether that may have been connected to the child molestation case and or the Temple of Set. It's not altogether clear whether those cases are connected, although there are indications that they may be. No indictments have been handed down, but there are a lot of interesting facets to that particular case. We're going to reflect on this brutal killing at the Presidio. We're also then going to take a look at the cancer death of a warrant officer in the Army's Criminal Investigation Division who had been working out of the Presidio and recently retired, then promptly died of cancer. We've taken a look in the past on this broadcast at the National Security Establishment's use of cancer as an assassination tool. It is a frequent assassination tool, and we've dealt at considerable length with that in the past. Then we're going to take a look again at the apparent dismissal of all criminal charges vis-a-vis the Presidio child molestation case, which many people feel is in fact connected to the Temple of Set, Michael Aquino and others' denials notwithstanding. We're specifically going to take a look at U.S. Attorney Joseph Russaniello, who's the fellow who presided over this case, and reflect on whether or not Russaniello may in fact be what perhaps we could refer to as an intelligence fixer. One of the reasons why it's so important to study the methodology used by the intelligence services, and one of the reasons why it's so important to study this country's political assassinations, is the fact that an intelligent hands-on review of these events yields the awareness that, in fact, there are certain personalities within the judicial system that are utilized time and time again by the intelligence services in order to cover up one or another of their scams when they come to light. We are certainly not going to point the finger of guilt at Joseph Russaniello, but there are some indications here that he may, note again the use of the term may, be just such a fixer, a la, say, Leon Jaworski or others. We're going to take a look at Joseph Russaniello's curious behavior in a case in San Francisco related to the possibility of contra drug smuggling. Specifically, there was a cocaine bust in San Francisco, and it involved apparently contra drug smuggling funds, which in turn were being used to fund the contra war in Nicaragua. Interestingly enough, the proceeds from the cocaine case were sent down to the Contras in Nicaragua, and the fellow who presided over that, you guessed it, Joseph P. Russaniello, the same fellow. Again, we're not pointing the finger of guilt at him. Maybe he's a saint. He acts like a sinner. We shall reflect on this at some length during the meat of the broadcast. We're going to conclude this evening by taking a look at the untimely death of the woman whose testimony and activities were foremost in bringing the McMartin preschool child molestation case to court in Southern California. She dropped dead as soon as the case came to court, practically, and we're going to reflect on her death as well. That's what we have on tap for this evening. And again, if you are in a position to do so, tape tonight's broadcast, because that's what it's for. Now, we're going to take a look at the first article in tonight's broadcast right now. Following story comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of March 11th, 1988. Its headline, Defendant Guilty on Two Counts in San Francisco Satanic Torture Killing. A San Francisco jury continued deliberating on murder charges against Clifford St. Joseph yesterday after finding him guilty of false imprisonment and sodomy in the satanic, cult-like slaying of a still unidentified man. Skipping down, the victim's body was found wrapped in a plastic garbage bag on 6th Street on June 15th, 1985. A five-pointed star had been carved into his chest, his body had been drained of blood, and he had been sexually mutilated. Note the draining of the blood. We're going to touch back on that later in the broadcast. Police said St. Joseph, a 46-year-old waiter, is believed to be a member of a, quote, gay satanic cult, unquote. And acquaintances testified that St. Joseph had tortured and killed the victim. St. Joseph denied any involvement in the ritualistic slaying of the man. Well, we're going to take a look now at another case, and the thing to reflect on here is gay satanic cults. I've no doubt that there are, in fact, such things, wouldn't even begin to want to say how common or prevalent something like that is. I will say that I haven't, as a long-time news hound and reader of multiple newspapers, I haven't seen any mention of gay satanic cults that I can recall in the papers to any significant extent in a long time. There are now articles talking about these kinds of things appearing. One of the things I think listeners should reflect on, and again, rumination here is important, but not something you want to mistake for hard research here, and it's a hard fact. One wants to reflect on why perhaps we may be seeing these kinds of stories. Bear in mind it's election time. Bear in mind that during election years, and this is a presidential election year, it is frequently a tactic of those who wish to exercise totalitarian methodology to inflame political passions and to manipulate those passions once they have been so inflamed. Reflect on that against the context of tonight's broadcast. Also, the five-pointed star and the mutilation of the body here, in particular, the draining of blood, is something to be taken note of. We will come back to that later in the broadcast. yet another article dealing with the possibility of, you know, gay satanic cults, quote-unquote. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of March 7th, 1988. It's by Edward W. Lempin, an L-E-M-P-I-N-E-N, a Chronicle staff writer. It's headlined, Jail Child Molester May Have Spread AIDS to Boys. San Francisco investigators fear that AIDS may have been spread to a number of boys and young men by a man sentenced to prison last month for child molestation. Police say they found documents in the 6th Street Hotel of James David White indicating that he had tested positive at least once for the AIDS virus. White, linked by police to a pedophile network called the North American Man-Boy Love Association, NAMBLA, also kept documents indicating that he had sexual contact with an estimated 139 youths ages 5 to 17 between 1971 and last year, said Sergeant Tom Eisenman. According to Eisenman, E-I-S-E-N-M-A-N-N, an inspector in the juvenile division, investigators have located only a few of White's victims. They have not confirmed whether he may have transferred the virus to anybody. Quote, my initial concern is that he would be doing these activities with kids and the kids would get AIDS, unquote, Eisenman said. It's an ever-present fear since he's attracted to children and since he wants to have sex with them, that he could easily spread it. Again, unquote. A related police investigation is underway in Massachusetts, where White and at least one of his alleged victims also had lived, Eisenman said. A chart apparently prepared by White and confiscated by police from his home last fall indicated that he had had sex with some of the boys and young men. As described by White, the nature of the sexual contacts poses a high risk for the spread of acquired immune deficiency syndrome. In the same search, police found two documents suggesting that Whites had tested positive for the AIDS virus. One was a single-page, typed, unsigned letter by White dated October 21st, just before his arrest. Let me run this down again, what the police found. In the same search, police found that this fellow has kept lists of the people he had sexual relations with, a chart apparently prepared by White and confiscated by police. I wonder if it was, it says apparently prepared by White. Think about you. The use of the phrase apparently is interesting here. I wonder if there is a possibility it was not prepared by James David White. But listen to this here, again repeating. In the same search, police found two documents suggesting that White had tested positive for the AIDS virus. One was a single-page, typed, unsigned letter by White dated October 21st, just before his arrest. Quote, bringing AIDS back to a personal basis. Didn't I tell you that I tested positive for exposure to the AIDS virus last year? He wrote to a man in Massachusetts. Well, I was a nervous wreck over the last couple of months. I nearly had a debilitating case of bronchitis that I feared was pneumonocystis carinii, a lung disease commonly associated with AIDS. Unquote. The second document was an October 9th bill from the Medical Center at the University of California at San Francisco for a September 24th visit that included lung x-rays and a test for the HIV antibody, which is associated with AIDS. Skipping down, after pleading guilty last month, he was sent to the California Medical Facility at Vacaville, where he awaits transfer to another prison. According to Eisenman and court records, White was convicted of child sexual abuse in 1981. White was convicted of child sexual abuse charges in 1981 in Santa Clara County. In the San Francisco case, he was named in 39 counts related to child molestation and showing child pornography to a minor. The investigation leading to his arrest focused on six boys ages 8 to 15. Also central to the investigation was the San Francisco chapter of NAMBLA, or NAMBLA, which boasts about 125 members in California and 600 worldwide. Eisenman and his partner, Sergeant Glenn Pamphiloff, P-A-M-F-I-L-O-F-F, said White has written for NAMBLA publications under pseudonyms. David M. Simons, 28, who belonged to the group until about 1985, was also arrested after the investigation on charges of child molestation and showing pornography to a minor. Although he is apparently no longer a member, police and NAMBLA officials say Simons worked at the Market Street bookstore where the group sells many of its publications, lived in a room behind the shop, and attended monthly NAMBLA meetings there. Former Bay Area broadcast journalist Eugene J. McCann, Jr., a friend of both White and Simons, also was arrested on similar charges. Simons pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 7 years in prison, while McCann pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 28 months. Police said White and McCann are associates of another convicted child molester, 51-year-old Robert E. Newman, who is connected locally to a national Satanist cult known as the Ordo Templi Orientis, or OTO. In a raid on Newman's Dolores Street home last year, investigators found a large ceremonial altar, NAMBLA literature, and documents from a variety of occult groups, including the OTO. NAMBLA has come under intense police scrutiny since it was founded in Boston 10 years ago. In recent years, men with close ties to the group have been arrested in Sacramento, San Bernardino, Boston, and the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Take note in particular here of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Quote, it is an organization that promotes child sexual abuse, unquote, Eisenman said. Free Forum Books at 1800 Market Street continues to host NAMBLA meetings and to sell NAMBLA literature, including explicit but legal fictional accounts of men having sex with boys as young as 8. The group contends that age of consent laws that regulate children's sexual activity should be abolished and that children should have the right to have sex, even in infancy. Well, there are a lot of things to mull over in connection with that article. One of the things that I was struck by is, again, I've been reading a lot of newspapers for a long time here, and I haven't seen much about gay satanic cults. I have no doubt that there are such things. I wonder perhaps why we're seeing this publicity here in this context. In particular here, note that James David White has AIDS, and there's the possibility of his having spread it to other people. I wonder, obviously, and I'll in a sense look ahead to the latter parts of the broadcast, is whether we're dealing here with a very, very effective and subtle form of provocation and psychological warfare, perhaps part of the Push for Bush campaign. At the very least, I think this is a de facto very effective psy war and propaganda device for the American far right and for fascism in general. I mean, just consider here what we're looking at here is the possibility of child molesting homosexuals with AIDS, you know, or child molesting homosexuals from hell with AIDS is what we're dealing with here. Again, the mention of the OTO here, there was a disclaimer a few days later in the Chronicle in which someone from the OTO maintained that this fellow was a former OTO member and that was not, in fact, a member of the organization. Again, take note of that in the context of the earlier discussion, whether the types of activities that have frequently been associated in certain contexts with OTO are, in fact, ex-members, rogue sections, infiltrated sections, or whatever, remains to be determined. There is a lot of investigating to be done in the direction of the organization, not necessarily impugning the organization or anybody in it. I'm not necessarily exonerating the organization of anybody in it. They officially disclaim this kind of thing, and indeed, if our hypothesis here is correct, and that in fact intelligence services have been infiltrating occult groups, satanic cults, what have you, it is no knock on the organization necessarily or anybody in it necessarily to say that these kinds of activities may be being pursued without the knowledge or consent of the leadership. But again, the OTO tendrils here are worth thinking about. Also, the fact that apparently there are some North American Man-Boy Love Association groups at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. We had taken a look in conjunction with the Presidio child molestation case of child molestations at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And I wonder here, taking note of the single-page typed unsigned letter by White, we can't jump to any conclusions and shouldn't in that context, but again, a study of intelligence machinations, and in particular of U.S. political assassinations in the past, makes it very clear that one of the things they do is they have planted letters, planted diaries, things that are deliberately meant to point in the direction of a given individual that they mean to incriminate. Again, we can draw no conclusions from this, but it's very, very interesting. It's difficult to imagine a subject, again, which would panic the public more than this. Gay child molesters from hell with AIDS. Think about that. And again, we're going to reflect on this against the background of the Fritz Haarmann case. And bear in mind now that the whole issue of homosexuality, and there was a fairly vital nascent gay rights movement in Weimar Germany, was used to tar progressive politics in that country during that period of time. It's also worth noting, again, that the Fritz Hermann case was one of the central propaganda centerpieces in the whole Nazi propaganda blitz vis-a-vis gay rights. It's worth remembering, too, that the Nazis in their propaganda frequently portrayed homosexuality as a disease, as an epidemic, as a threat to the German body politic as a whole. It's worth remembering, too, that in their anti-gay and their homophobic literature, the Nazis, among other things, had made use, Himmler and the SS, made use of a chart of a renegade SS person who was, in fact, a gay, and they made a chart of all of his various liaisons. It's sort of reminiscent not only of the chart here that James David White allegedly made, but also brings to mind the case of Gaetan Dugas, the centerpiece of Randy Schultz's book And the Band Played On, the lone nut, so to speak, who allegedly brought AIDS to the United States. We, obviously skeptical of Schultz's account, have referred to him as Lee Harvey AIDS in the past. But the charting of the liaisons of Gaetan Dugas, the charting of the liaisons of a renegade SS man by Himmler that we referred to in our archive tape, The Pink Triangle, is reminiscent here of the charting of the liaisons of James David White here. And again, we're going to reflect on all of this against the background of the Fritz Hermann case. Consider, again, the utility of this type of article, well, in general, for producing political reaction as a tool of propaganda, provocation, and psychological warfare, in particular, in an election year. Consider the following article on the same subject. This from the San Jose Mercury News of Monday morning, March 21st of 1988. This is an article by Linda Goldston of the San Jose Mercury News. Its headline, Threat of AIDS Looms Over Sex Assault Victims. In the Bay Area, police are searching for dozens of boys who may have contracted AIDS from a convicted child molester. In Los Angeles, a 13-year-old boy who was anally raped 2 years ago has tested positive for AIDS. So have two female rape victims. The cases may be the beginning of a simmering national tragedy among as yet unknowable numbers of victims of rape and molestations whose attackers have condemned them to death. The molester is serving a prison term, but the boy is serving a death sentence, Mia Baker, Special Assistant District Attorney in Los Angeles, said of the 13-year-old boy who was infected with the AIDS virus. Officials say the issue of AIDS and victims of assault is explosive and complicated. State law prevents anyone, including sex offenders, from being tested for AIDS without consent, leaving no way to measure the potential threat. For now, the emergence of incidents in which sexual assault victims have been infected only hints at the problems to come. And so, again, certainly I think any parent reading this is likely to be somewhat unsettled at the prospects for their children's futures. It's worth reflecting again on the James David White case, and it's worth reflecting on a very, very important apparent provocation that we've talked about in the past here on this program, namely the Fritz Hermann case. It is now time to broadcast the section from our archive show called The Pink Triangle, subtitled Gay Rights, Reproductive Rights in the Third Reich. Specifically now, we're going to be broadcasting a section from that program about the Fritz Hermann case, and then we're going to ruminate on this against the background of the James David White situation in San Francisco. This will probably be, about 15 minutes worth of tape. There'll be a slight interruption while we change tape cassettes in the middle here, so bear with us, a little over-the-counter radio. So here is the Pink Triangle, and specifically the Fritz Hermann case. By the way, the book in question here is called The Pink Triangle. The author is Richard Plant. And this, the full archive tape, The Pink Triangle, is available from Archives on Audio. Here's our section about the Fritz Hermann case. To one of the most important parts of this book, a key apparent provocation which was used to defame the gay rights movement, to attribute to join in the public's mind liberalism and homosexuality and murder. And again, this was used very cleverly by the Nazis, and as we're going to talk about, something which has unnerving reflections for contemporary America. This is the Fritz Hermann case.
We're going to be continuing here from the Pink Triangle. The Fritz Hermann that Dave refers to, the name is spelled H-A-A-R-M-A-N-N, just so you know. The film, however, was of minor importance for the homosexual rights movement compared with the shocking murders that occurred in Hanover in 1923 and 1924, culminating in the trial of a certain Fritz Haarmann. Simply put, it was a disaster for Hirschfeld's and the committee's efforts to liberalize the law. It splintered the movement irreparably, fed every prejudice against homosexuality, and provided new fodder for conservative adversaries of legal sex reform. In addition, it pitted the Social Democrats unwillingly against the Communist Party. Most historians of the Weimar Republic have neglected the trial, but Haarmann dominated the headlines for months, and the passions he aroused did much to weaken the struggle to abolish paragraph 175. The trial took place during July 1924 in Hanover, a medium-sized northern city, a place known as much for its black market as for its huge number of prostitutes and hustlers. Interestingly enough, Hanover had been the birthplace of Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, who, it will be recalled, had been among the first in the 19th century to urge greater tolerance toward homosexuals, writing over the course of many years a dozen books that were collectively titled Researches on the Riddle of Love Between Men. Until 1869, when the stringent Prussian penal code was extended, Hanover was one of the handful of German states that did not punish homosexuality. Fritz Haarmann, a homosexual small-time crook who had spent most of his life in and out of insane asylums and prisons, sold second-hand clothing and jewelry and third-rate food, mostly meat. He also acted as a police informer, which for a time saved him from being suspected of a series of spectacular murders. It was Haarmann's habit to pick up, quote, for interrogation, unquote, destitute youngsters at Hanover's railroad station or some other center of the black market. He then took them to one of his ever-changing slum apartments near the banks of the Leine River. He murdered some, but others he let go. Of those he killed, he cut off head and limbs, severed the flesh, fed it through a grinder and sold it in small, well-wrapped packages as horse meat. The black market absorbed all this until too many skulls and bones were found washed up on the banks of the Leine River. As more details were uncovered, it emerged that Haarmann not only carried a police badge, but had founded his own phony detective agency. Haarmann, though a psychopath of low intelligence and no grasp of reality, did possess a shrewd talent for deceit, and he had actually assisted the police in solving several crimes. He confessed readily. He did not recall details, names, faces. He remembered that sometimes, overcome by sexual rage, he bit through his victims' throats, and thus ancient tales of werewolves and vampires were thrown into the legal proceedings. Altogether, criminologists and pathologists reconstructed 147 cases of missing persons. Hirschfeld was called from Berlin as an expert witness, but he never wrote about the case. Conservative businessman Friedrich Radziweit, head of the League for Human Rights, did. He sent a letter to the leading newspapers in which he strongly protested, quote, the yellow press, which tried to identify homosexuals with this feeble-minded criminal. The homosexual minority in our nation emphatically rejects these insulting remarks, which equate homosexuality with criminality, unquote. Haarmann admitted to 127 murders and asked to be executed. He alternated between crying and cajoling and pleaded insanity. The court sentenced him to death.
Those of you who are taping off the air, we're going to change tapes now. Those of you who eventually hear the program by tape, there'll be a short pause while we effect some engineering changes here.
Before we go on here, I just want to put the idea in people's minds of the idea of a feeble-minded criminal who somehow managed to yet pull off incredible crimes for which an entire group of people are branded. And I'm going to let Dave read a little bit more, and then we'll talk about some similarities to another feeble-minded criminal that managed to turn up to the Nazis' aid and comfort a little later on.
Now, continuing with the Pink Triangle. Journalists were admonished to play everything down. The Hanover officials wanted no panic. Reporters were also encouraged not to investigate the role of the police. I'm going to repeat that last sentence again. Reporters were also encouraged not to investigate the role of the police. It was on this point that the communists unleashed an avalanche of criticism against the hated Social Democrats. The post of police commissioner of Hanover was held by Gustav Noske, G-U-S-T-A-V-N-O-S-K-E, who, years before, had beaten back left-wing demonstrators by using Reichswehr and Freikorps troops, or Freikorps troops. Originally, Gustav Noske was a social democrat, but he had acted with a vengeance that the radical labor rebels never forgave. He was hated as much as his superior, Karl Severing, S-E-V-E-R-I-N-G, the Prussian Minister of the Interior and also a social democrat. Altogether, Severing and Noske had put behind bars about 7,000 workers. When the local communist paper, the Niederösterreichische Arbeitszeitung, began to reveal the net of police connections Harman had established as a stool pigeon, its circulation jumped from 8,000 to 35,000. As soon as Noske returned from a vacation, he had the newspaper declared injurious to public safety and banned it. I'm going to read those last two sentences again. When the local communist paper, the Niederösterreichische Arbeitszeitung, began to reveal the net of police connections Harman had established as a stool pigeon, its circulation jumped from 8,000 to 35,000. As soon as Noske returned from a vacation, he had the newspaper declared injurious to public safety and banned it. Rather curious behavior there under the circumstances. Okay, now, again, we're affecting a few engineering difficulties so that we don't have our ID on the tape. Basically, the main points in this particular passage are several. There's several very important points. First of all, as Nip pointed out, the unlikelihood of a feeble-minded individual being able to pull off 127 murders of this type, even in an area which is undergoing the social chaos that Germany was in this historical period. Remember, 1924, which is when this is going on, 3 years after the founding of the Nazi Party, roughly, this was at the height, or the depth, perhaps, of the German inflation. Germany was completely ravaged economically. Still, it appears extremely unlikely that a true feeble-minded person would have been able to pull this off. It is more than a little enlightening that this person was not only a police informer, but apparently ran a network of other police informers, had his own phony detective agency, carried a police badge, and more revealing still is the official reaction when the communist paper began to highlight this. They shut the paper down, they encouraged reporters not to look into the role of the police, and still more significantly, perhaps, the police commissioner of Hanover at this time was a fellow named Gustav Noske. Now, Gustav Noske is a very, very important figure from the history of this period. Now, let's review just a little bit of the history of Weimar Germany so that what we're about to read here makes more sense. At the end of the First World War, due to a lot of things, that the terrible economic conditions imposed by a rigorous British naval blockade, the devastation of the war in the trenches to the population, and plus continuing political turmoil within Germany from the pre-war years, had created basically an untenable situation for the German people. When militarily, particularly because of the entry of the United States, the war became untenable for the high command, and when it was learned that in fact Erich von Ludendorff, the chief of the German general staff, was suing for peace, a revolution broke out in Germany. There were a series of left-wing uprisings for about a two-year period in Germany. Well, actually more than that, but a series of serious left-wing uprisings in Germany for a period of roughly a year and a half to 2 years, beginning roughly in November of 1918 and proceeding until late 1919. Now, in order to put down these abortive communist uprisings, the Social Democrats, who themselves were a relatively liberal group, but who relied heavily on middle-class support, joined forces with the German military high command, and not only was the regular Reichswehr used to suppress these uprisings, but in particular, a series of volunteer military organizations were put together, and it was chiefly these volunteer military organizations, most importantly, the Freikorps, or Freikorps, that put down the abortive German uprisings. Later, as we looked at in a couple of our programs, Radio Free America number 10, also an old Hard Rain broadcast, which is still on file with archives on audio, we took a look at the Freikorps and the so-called Black Reichswehr, which resulted when the Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren, the Civil Guards, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, the all-volunteer civil guards, were basically these organizations, although officially established by the Weimar government, remained in power even after they were officially disbanded. They functioned as an underground extension of the German military, and they were bitterly opposed to the Weimar Republic. They systematically assassinated not only the communists and leftists, but also all political opponents that could have stopped Adolf Hitler.
Hitler's rise to power was essentially paved by the so-called Black Reichswehr, the Freikorps assassinations, okay? Now, interestingly enough, it was Gustav Noske who was in charge of the National Security Establishment in Weimar, Germany, and it was Gustav Noske, more than any other individual, who put together the Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, which wound up exterminating democracy in Germany. We're going to talk about Gustav Noske. This comes from a book called Paramilitary Politics in Weimar, Germany. It's by James M. Diehl, last name D-I-E-H-L. It's published by the Indiana University Press, and copyright, I believe, 1977. Let me find the title page. Yeah, copyright 1977, Indiana University Press, Bloomington and London, it says here. Now, of Gustav Noske and his role in forming the German volunteer military organizations which wound up subverting democracy in Weimar, Germany, although they were pledged to defend it and formed initially to defend it, G. Diehl writes as follows. The decision of the Supreme Command during the final weeks of 1918 to cooperate with the government in the creation of a volunteer force was born of necessity, but the situation offered certain advantages. Since the new forces would be hired and paid for by the government, but directed by the Supreme Command, the latter would shape and control the new military force while at the same time avoiding direct responsibility. Adroitly capitalizing on the Social Democratic leader's fear of the left, the OHL, that's German Military High Command, got what it wanted. Government support for the creation of a volunteer force plus a free hand in forming it. The withdrawal of the independent members of the Council of People's Representatives in late December and the appointment of Gustav Noske as minister in charge of military affairs greatly facilitated the growth of the volunteer system. Noske, a right-wing social democrat, shared Ebert's fear of the left and, like him, believed the best way to build a new military force was in cooperation with the old military authorities. With Noske's cooperation and support, the OHL's efforts to replace the rapidly disintegrating conscript army with a volunteer force soon bore fruit. It was these forces, recruited and led by former officers, that were to restore order in the Reich during the first half of 1919. The volunteer forces, which consisted of three types, Freikorps or Freikorps, auxiliary volunteer units, Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, and civil guards, Einwohnerwehren, effectively restored order but soon evolved into independent power factors outside the control of the government. By creating, or better, by supporting the creation of a system of volunteer forces and then failing to control it, the new government lost, or failed to achieve, an effective monopoly of armed force and sowed the seeds for the latter paramilitary activity that was to plague the Republic. Although the nature and type of activity of the three volunteer organizations differed, they shared one characteristic. All turned against the Republic.
Continuing with paramilitary politics in Weimar, Germany. Since the Reichswehr was still in its infancy, the Freikorps, or Freikorps, were probably the single most important power in Germany. Technically, the achievements of Noske and the Supreme Command had been extraordinary. From the shattered and dispirited remains of the defeated German Imperial Army, they had in the space of a few months forged an effective fighting force, which had restored order out of chaos and successfully defended the Ebert government from its enemies on the left. These technical achievements were accompanied by a legacy of brutality and bitterness, however, and were to have serious political and social consequences. Now, this is Gustav Noske. This is the man who started as the essentially the chief of police in Hanover, the legal authority in Hanover, where Fritz Haarmann had his reign of terror. Noske obviously got on the career fast track because he was, as we've just detailed for you, wound up being in charge of the military forces of Weimar Germany when the various Free Corps and other, I guess what you'd have to call not only the street fighters, the death squads, were first put together.
Precisely, and the parallel with the death squads in Latin America formed by our own national security establishment, also the ones apparently working in the United States, is more than a little instructive here.
Indeed, and also just, again, to remain topical, the ones that are just even now as we speak being formed in the Philippines due to another executive fiat.
Less direct, but potentially of even greater danger to the Republic, was the manner in which they militarized the police mentality of those predominantly middle-class Germans who flocked to their colors.